Hey, I'm Josh Barrow, your new host of Left, Right, and Center. Every week, join Rich Lowry, Bob Scheer, and me for a contentious yet civilized debate of the week's big political stories, from ISIS to the U.S. economy to this 47-candidate presidential election we're having. You can find Left, Right, and Center on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, who I've finally got on the show, is someplace I've run into many times in Austin, Comic-Con a couple years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
We've run into each other so many places. Yeah. I finally get a chance to sit down with a man who you may know from I Love You, Man, or Forgetting Sarah Marshall, or for a very long run on some TV show. Josh Radnor's been here a few times, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, his new film, where he gets to play David Foster Wallace, is the end of the tour. Jason Segel, thanks for being here.
Thanks, man.
Well, it's something I'm sure you talk about a lot, but it's really evident in your portrayal in this movie. Yeah. There's something musical about the way you act.
Oh, interesting.
Because, I mean, this is kind of a series of soliloquies.
Yeah.
And I can sort of tell there's kind of a pitch to some of them. And some of them are more melodic. Some of them are more forceful. It's in musical terms, the performance exists in that way for me, first and foremost.
That's a really interesting thing that you say that. Well, when I watched David Foster Wallace's interview with Charlie Rose, something really struck me. There's a way that he's moving his hands. And the first thing that I thought of was that movie Minority Report, where
Tom Cruise is doing
He has that screen and he's moving information around. And I thought, oh, it seems as though that's what David Foster Wallace is doing. He's conducting language. He's constructing these monologues off the cuff, fully formed arguments with like a thesis, supporting points, and a conclusion.
And basically argue with himself in some ways.
And I felt like he had so much information at his disposal, it was almost a matter of curating for him. You know, it's just a giant brain. And so I think that conducting language sort of popped into my mind, and it became very musical for me. But music has always been a good friend of mine.
Sure, of course. But, I mean, yeah. I thought some of these characters we played were talking about How I Met Your Mother, yeah, or Forgetting Sarah Marshall, or I Love You, Man. These are guys who live in their own heads,
yeah,
in a way that other people don't. They tend to live in bubbles.
Yeah, right.
And I wonder if that's something that attracts you as an actor, these characters who have kind of built a world around themselves.
Yeah, well, I think that that's sort of been my experience. If I have to search for a connection, I was a high school athlete. And when
you
I started—
You were a serious b-ball player.
I was a
high school
player.
That's touching. I was a high school— Now you sound like David Foster Wallace. Yeah, I was a high school athlete.
Yeah, I won a state championship.
Dude, you guys were ranked.
Yeah, we were ranked. Yeah, my nickname was Dr. Dunk, which is humiliating now.
Only if you still have the shoes with Dr. Dunk on the side of them.
No, but I had a hat that said Dr. Dunk that I had made at the swap meet in one of those robots that does cursive for you, and it just looked like Dr. Dirk. Everybody would say, hey, Dr. Dirk. Anyways, I decided I wanted to start making short films. It was right at the time when Apple made things very easy to do at home, when you could start editing the first Final Cut. Yes, that's right. And there were digital cameras that were affordable. The only thing was I wasn't friends with actors. And so I went out and I bought a bunch of puppets. And I started making short films with these puppets. And it's how I learned how to write. It's how I learned puppetry. And it's how I learned how to sort of put together a visual narrative. So I think, I mean, that's living in your own head, isn't it? My friends were puppets.
No, I'm not tearing up at all. It doesn't sound sad by any means. But it's interesting because this idea, these people who have like create these narratives in their heads.
Yeah.
So you're saying this is much autobiographical, at least you're pulling from yourself as anything else for these guys.
Well, I certainly relate to it. I really do. I think there are times, if I'm perfectly honest, where if you were filming me on CC, it would look like I was just sitting there and inside my brain there's a war going on. Like I am at war with imaginary people. I should have said this to this guy. I should have handled it this way. And then on the videotape, it would just look like me sitting there. It's like with a vague smile.
Can you think of the first time you actually kind of used this in playing a character? I mean, because it almost goes back to me a bit to Freaks and Geeks, or even we could say a little bit to Knocked Up. These are all guys who, in some way, you know, they've constructed kind of a planet around themselves, and they're like inviting us into them.
Well, yeah, I think even more than the acting, I think that this is essentially what it is to be a writer. You're imagining every one of the characters, you're having conversations. The difference, the skill of being a writer is learning to type that stuff.
Wow, we just basically got a whole bunch of people now writing off. You can type, you can do it. But
well,
no.
I'll tell you, you know, you hear a lot of people like, oh, I'm halfway through a screenplay, or I've got a great idea for a screenplay. The idea isn't necessarily the hard part. I think the hard part, I mean, this leads right into talking about something like Infinite Jest, which is 1,000 pages. But the hard part is the discipline of sitting down and getting to the end. That is incredibly lonely and difficult. And, you know, for a screenplay, that's 3 months of, no, I can't meet you for dinner. I can't go do that fun thing. I have to write. I thought so much in prep for this movie. Infinite Jest is 1,000-plus pages and a difficult 1,000 pages. And the rough draft of it, I think, was 500 pages longer. So that is years of, no, I can't meet you for dinner. And you're laboring under the belief the whole time that what you're writing is going to make sense or matter to anybody or is worth doing. That is a very particular personality type. I've thought a lot about how underneath anyone who does something creative, underneath any sort of external personality type is this binding belief that what you have to say is worthy of people paying money for and devoting their full attention to. I think that's a very interesting thing to have within you.
Is that something you've always thought about in terms of it being a story that would play out to the larger world, or were you just basically trying to get these stories out of your head, you know, kind of exorcise them a little bit?
I think that I like to make people happy. I know that that sounds a little cliched or trite or something like that, but I think there's something really nice when you see somebody who says, like, I loved that thing, or that got me through law school, or I had a bad breakup and I saw Forgetting Sarah Marshall and that really helped. That feels cool. It's like there's a weird kind of alchemy of thinking of an idea on your couch and then it comes out and people get to watch it and experience it however they want.
It's funny you're saying that, though, because I just remember in reading David Lipsky's book that he talks about, you, in some ways, your ideal casting in this, because he really describes Wallace as an athlete, this guy with a bounce, and also, in this weird way, also kind of self-contained, too.
Yeah. Well, there's also a competitiveness that never leaves you, I think, once you've played a competitive sport. You want to win. And that's what I think is interesting about their dynamic as characters, Lipsky and David Foster Wallace in this movie, but also even acting next to Jesse. There's something about it that is like a friendly but competitive tennis match where you need the other person to volley. Like if you want to get some exercise, you need them. But the whole time you're thinking like, when do I level the winning blow? I want to beat this person as well. You feel that throughout the movie.
You do. And there's also, we're talking about tennis, there's that control of the speed of the game.
That's right.
That means as much as anything else. I mean, you can volley, but when you get inside of somebody else's time and they're waiting for that shot that you don't give to them, which is the kind of way you play Foster, this way that he doesn't, it sounds like he's being faster than he actually is to me, which is why I thought about musical meter.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, David Foster Wallace says, which is from the transcripts, but he says to Lipsky at one point, I can't quite keep up with you. And I think he means it. But this interview that David Foster Wallace agreed to with Lipsky lasts for 4 days. And I think at some point, as the subject of the interview, you get tired and you can't keep up this image that you're trying to project to the world. And I think that that's a really scary thing for him. So when he says, I can't keep up with you, I don't think he means in a debate setting. I think he means that you have the safety of knowing that you get to cut out anything stupid you say, but anything stupid I might say is fair game.
Which is why he did that thing that, and I remember in reading this, I was shocked that Lipsky gave permission. If I say something 5 minutes later, I want to take it back, I want permission to do that. Now, that's something that never happens in interviews. Somebody who's done print interviews, trust me, you don't do that after the fact.
That's right. Yeah. I don't know exactly what happened, but my guess would be that the minute David Foster Wallace hung up the phone after agreeing to this interview, it was pure regret and terror about the moment that was to come. If he's anything like me.
Do you get that fear, that anxiety about doing them?
I think that there is a fear of being exposed. I mean, this for him, this is 1996, so it's even lighter back then than it is now in the tabloid internet culture. The way that we relate to celebrity is you either want to sort of deify them or really knock them down to your size. And I think as the subject of the interviewer, you're kind of just you. You know, like I look at like an article that might say, they're just like us. They go shopping too. And you never feel like a they. I've never at any point felt like I made a transition from the us to the them category. But all of a sudden you realize there might be like a story that says like Jason Segel's fat beach body. Do you know? And you're like, oh, I've crossed over into some territory where you are allowed to say that, I guess. Like, you know?
Wow. We're hearing a lot from my guest, Jason Segel, who says all you have to do to write a screenplay is type. It's the treatment. He's starring as David Foster Wallace in the film The End of the Tour. I guess you're talking about that, though. That's even one of the things that he says in the intro to the book. He says that Wallace also had this ability to draw these two different poles out of people in rooms, you know, that all the women loved him and all the guys hated him because they wanted to be him. And when I heard you were doing this, it sounded kind of perfect to me because between the musicality, and we look at performances. I mean, I think of your performance in I Love You, Man, as almost like Dave Brubeck, you know, I mean, just sort of laying back and waiting for, I mean, just sort of doing 5/4 of something that sounds like it's traditional, really isn't.
Yeah.
And,
thanks.
But you know what I mean?
I do.
That kind of thing. And here it really is, it's almost like from Metallica to opera.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of sense of playing a lot of notes, but also in that way that an opera pauses are musical too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that David Foster Wallace did a lot of listening. When you listen to David Foster Wallace talk, he ends a lot of his very complex, very astute observations with, do you know what I mean? And I think he means that sincerely. Like, he wants a conversation. He wants to hear what you have to say. I had a friend once named Brian. He is the smartest guy that I know. And we would be in a room full of smart people, and they would be talking about a subject that he knew a lot about, and he wouldn't say a word. And then afterwards, I would say to him, why didn't you say anything? And he said, because I already know anything that I would have said. I'm not going to learn anything by talking. And it was one of the smartest things I ever heard anybody say. And I think that there is some truth to that. David Foster Wallace could outthink you on any subject, most likely, but he already knew the stuff that he might say.
But I wonder, too, because there's that thing that said in the book, but also you really get a sense of it in the essays more than in Infinite Jest, where going back to what I said at the beginning, he was carrying on these conversations with himself between the text and the footnotes, which was a whole other book, and an argument with basically the metaphors in the book. But that sense of, and we get a little bit of it from you in this performance, that he does have almost what people described as kind of a sixth sense, where he was so alive that his antenna were basically almost constantly operating.
Well, I have a very particular feeling about the endnotes, and here's my experience with them. If you decide to read Infinite Jest, I would not read it on an iPad because this experience won't translate. Buy the book, and it's this massive thing. You have to carry it around, and it's heavy. And you develop a relationship with the book itself, like even just carrying it around in a backpack daily is a thing. But you'll be like on page 50 of the book. It's just the beginning. You have so much more to go. And then you'll hit an endnote, and you'll have to flip to the back of this book. And then the endnote will be 50 pages on the minutia of tennis. And you'll trudge through it. You'll trudge through this thing. And then you'll get to the end of that endnote, and you'll feel a great sense of accomplishment because you're now physically at the end of the book. And then, boom, he makes you flop back to the beginning of the book, and you realize, oh, my God, I have so much more to go. And to me, when I read it, I was trying to get inside of the head of the writer, so I had a different, you know, thought process. But I thought, oh, how hard are you willing to work to get to know me? It felt like the move of a very complicated man.
And a man who's basically controlling time in that way we're talking about, which is, again, it gets back to athletics. And the thing that people always talk about in boxing is once you get inside somebody else's time, he can't fight you the same way
anymore.
Right. You own the ring.
Yeah.
But that's time is part of music as well. I mean, once you sort of get people to listen to the time you're playing in, then you kind of own it. And that's why I'd felt about his work, too. Is that it was all about the way he made time change for you.
You know, it's really interesting as you say that. Maybe that is the point of moving out of New York because for David Foster Wallace, I hadn't thought about it until this interview. I lived in New York for a while, and one of the things that I really felt like was I had no control over the time. New York is in control of itself. New York is its own personality. And when you step out the door, it is happening at the rhythm that it wants to happen, and you are going to go with it. It's like the moving sidewalk at the airport. And you can't – I couldn't find a way to slow down there mentally.
Yeah.
And, yeah, me getting out of there was – it was too fast for me.
Well, speaking of time, this is a good point to take a break. We've figured out so many things here.
Look at us.
I know, right? There's still another half of the show to go. My guess is Jason Segel's new film is The End of the Tourist, The Treatment. There's more to come.
Visit the Which Way LA blog for an extension of what Los Angeles is made of. News, arts, culture, and the fabric of Southern California, all in one place and updated daily. Check it out now at kcrw.com/whichwayla.
Welcome back to The Treatment. I'm hoping my guest cares what I have to say. It's Jason Segel. His new film as actor is The End of the Tour, a look at a conversation between an interview, really, between David Lipsky and David Foster Wallace. We were talking about time a little bit, though, and I feel like, and I wonder how conscious you are of this, that time, for me, in looking at your performances, just getting ready for this, watching these things, is so much the way these people take the world. I mean, in Forgetting Sarah Marshall, he's basically escaping time. He's going away from everything. You were talking a little bit about what New York was in the first half, and it feels like that relationship was that moving sidewalk, and he had to get off of it and go someplace else.
Right.
And in I Love You, Man, he goes to the man cave where he creates his own time there.
Yeah, interesting.
And I just wonder how conscious this feels to you, this idea of the way people use time to sort of claim the world for themselves and also affect the way they deal with other people.
Well, I'm analyzing this now for the first time, but I'll tell you my experience as Jason Segel, as a person versus a character, but at some point you realize like all these deadlines and this feeling of time moving and I have to get it done by this date or things like that. It's largely arbitrary and manufactured, this feeling of stress. And you see when you go someplace like Hawaii. I moved out of Los Angeles, for example, where I'm no longer surrounded by billboards and no longer surrounded by the churning business. And you realize, oh, everything's fine. Whoa, I felt really stressed out. Like, honestly, you take the 101 freeway, for those of us who are in Southern California, and you start driving north, and you hit something called, like, the Camarillo Pass. And all of a sudden, you drop down into, a different valley, and you feel like, oh, I've just exited some sort of collective, creative neuroses, and I feel better. Talk about time. Like, my internal rhythm calms down, and you suddenly realize, oh, I don't know what I was so worried about. So, yeah, I think that that's true. I think taking back your time is an important thing.
Because as you were talking, I just wonder, when you were playing ball as a kid, I mean, that's one thing where it's not arbitrary. I mean, every second does matter.
Right.
And you've got to not only be thinking about basically going out to making the play, but trying to read what's going to happen when the other team gets the ball down court. You got to be thinking about that, too, because at some point, you're going to lose possession, whether you make a basket or not. The ball goes away from you.
Look, I was on the bench a lot, so it all felt like an eternity.
It wasn't moving nearly as fast as you described. Things felt very casual to me.
I guess that's Southern California basketball for you, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. It explains the Lakers to me.
But, yeah.
But I think that's kind of interesting. I mean, I just like the idea that I don't know where this came from, but I just was thinking about how so many of these performances relate to music.
Yeah.
And again, which takes us back to time. And I just wonder if you, as you're sitting down doing this, you talked about conducting and playing waltz, but was there any other kind of music that was going through your head as you were, because you've got to get these monologues right, which are not just, they sound like monologues, but they're really soliloquies because you're trying to, actually they're really dialogues.
Well, yeah, that's the really important thing. The pitfall going in, I think, is it's sounding like two smart guys reciting smart things in turn. That's the worst version. Not even together, just like one person says it, then the next person. You needed to know it so well that you weren't thinking about the words. But then more importantly, you really had to understand what you were saying so that they felt like your thoughts. That is a tricky thing because a lot of what they're saying is very specific to them and is so wildly intelligent, you know. I spent most of my time just really trying to understand what I was saying. I know that that sounds like a very simple thing, but really understand it. Like, what is his choice of words is very specific. I mean, he worked for the dictionary, you know, towards the end of his life. So his choice of words, but also what's underneath them, because a lot of what's going on, I think, in the movie is subtext. It's two guys who sort of have the armor of great vocabulary, but what's happening underneath that?
Yeah, because I thought the real trickiness is too is not only do you have to know that stuff inside and out, but you got to make it feel like you're listening to somebody else.
That's right.
Because it's not just, I said soliloquies, but they're really dialogues. And there are words that are chosen very specifically in response to something someone else has said.
Yeah. It's really amazing what James Ponsoldt, the director, did. There are scenes.
He did The Spectacular Now. He used to
yes,
for that movie.
And Smashed, which is one of my favorite movies.
Which is, again, another movie about somebody sort of in a bubble.
That's right.
You can say the same thing about Miles Teller in Spectacular
Now.
Yeah,
that's right. When I saw the movie for the first time, there were scenes where I'm doing most of the talking. And he will stay on Jesse Eisenberg's eyes because the scene is about Jesse listening. To create a narrative out of active listening it's a miracle.
But also interesting, too, because and it's something else maybe relates to time, too, but more of that physical thing we're talking about. You're an actor who's really aware of who and where yourself physically. And because there's a sequence when you guys come back from a night with a couple of friends where it's almost like The Odd Couple with Oscar and Felix with the Pigeon Sisters.
Yeah.
And you're not speaking, but you're also kind of slumped just from sort of frustration and rage and bitterness. And I'm really aware of the way you use your sizeness, because there's sometimes you just use your hands in front of him. We get a chance to see how big your hands are compared to his head.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you thought about that too.
I did. It means so much to me that you watched the movie with such care, by the way. Thank you. Yeah, I was very aware of the physical difference in size between Jesse and I. And at one point, actually, James Ponsoldt came up. David Foster Wallace was a very handsy talker when you watch interviews with him. And James came up at one point and said, you need to be careful about the way you move your hands. You're just so big physically that you look like you might attack him. I mean, I kind of look like a bear in front of him. But yeah, I was very aware of size. I also gained like 30 pounds for the movie. And that does something to you. Do you know what I mean? Like every night feels
like you're somebody who's, as well as he's constantly eating sugar.
Yeah.
Or drinking diet soft drinks.
Yeah, so diet like, right. Yeah. I just felt most of the time during the making of that movie and the months leading up, I felt like how you feel Thanksgiving night. Just kind of tired and ready for a nap and done. And I didn't really want to do much. And it was very helpful in playing the part, but I remember when I lost a bunch of the weight, the guy who had like trained me to lose the weight handed me the 25-pound, whatever you call that, the plate, you know, that you would lift with.
Oh, sure.
And he said, I want you to walk around with that for a minute. And I did. It was so heavy. He said, that's been on your body. That's why you felt so tired. You've been walking around
carrying that weight.
And that affects you.
Wow, because that's one of the things I was going to say where – that's where I got the sense that you made this David Foster Wallace your own, because in seeing the interviews, and I met him a couple of times.
Yeah.
We actually talked about our adult film award experiences, which I'll tell you about
later.
Oh,
wow.
I had to go to one of those ones, but I'll tell you about
that's one of the great essays he wrote, too.
But that's how we ended up connecting, because I did one of those ones here, but it's another story.
Oh, my gosh.
But you got the sense that he was constantly sort of like, his eyes were like glowing, so there's always this kind of almost like one of the, like he's Cyclops from the X-Men, that he's going to bore through you.
Right.
And that almost that bounce, but you chose to play it slower. Was it always just a consequence of gaining the weight? Was there
– no.
There was something else – because despite him seeming like kind of lost in his thoughts or whatever, the way you play him is very deliberate, and that's why I mentioned the physicality.
Yeah. Well, it's the end of the tour. It's the last 4 days of this tour, and I think that I had access to these recordings, to Lipsky's recordings, and there is a moment in the recordings where David Foster Wallace just sounds done. You know what I mean? Like – I'm done. And he's tired. And I think more importantly even than that is the end of the tour is even different than a week before. I'm at the end of a tour right now. This is my last interview for the end of the tour. And I'm excited. But I think David Foster Wallace at that moment was in a lot of fear, because what you go back to as a writer is a blank page. And that is a terrifying thing. Let me tell you, as an actor, I, on this tour, am always met with the question, what's next, right? Imagine being asked that after you've just unloaded a 1,000-page book. You don't even know if you can do it again. You don't know if you have it in you. And some interviewer is going to be like, oh, they haven't even read Infinite Jest yet, believe me. And then they're like, hey, so what's next? Any fun pranks while you were writing the book?
Wow, that's a stopper. My guest who just used the word excited, nobody's ever used that in the show before, is Jason Segel. His new film as an actor is The End of the Tour. But that was one of the reasons, too, I have to say, I was thinking about music, because if you see a performer at the beginning of a tour and the end of a tour,
yeah,
or if you go see actors on stage at the beginning of the run and the end of the run,
yeah,
they're very different things.
Sure.
And you can sort of tell that at a certain point, you're going to ask the questions like, what's next, or things that you've answered before. And you can sort of see in this Wallace, because he is so deliberate and in his way kind of a performer,
mm-hmm,
but also he's part of an audience.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that connects, I think, Wallace for me to you,
mm,
is that he's a performer as well, be it on the page or in person.
I think a lot of the benefit for him is having done Profiles from the Other Side. He knew how this game worked, and I think that's some of his frustration, is I wish I was doing this profile on myself. You know, I could make it interesting, and I would add just enough controversy, and I'd come off just the way I want to come off. Like, I think David Foster Wallace probably the whole time was thinking, I wish I was doing this on my own.
Because part of it for me, and I even get this from you, there's a bit of impatience of, and sort of the arrogance of, I know my word choice will be better than his. A little bit of that. You know, that if you're an athlete, you got to go into the game thinking you're better than somebody else.
Yeah, that's right. It's sometimes a delusion, but that's the athletic delusion, is I'm gonna kill him. You know, I'm going to smash the other team.
Yes, yes, you yes, know? Yes.
And like the Bad News Bears go into every game thinking that too. It's not true.
But when they come to think of, that's the danger. And by that point, you know, you think about it, that's what he come to think it. I mean, he'd gone from being this guy who written these two little books, the first book nobody saw,
right,
to being this guy who was going around the country filling up bookstores, which is a really hard thing to do.
Yeah. Well, there's a reason, though. And I think that David Foster Wallace, in my opinion, was justified in feeling like he had something special and unique to offer. But a lot of that has to do with bravery.
How do you mean?
I think that a lot of us feel the ways that Infinite Jest is thematic of, you know, these feelings of loneliness, these feelings of emptiness. And we as people spend a lot of time trying not to acknowledge that. And David Foster Wallace, despite being kind of a dude, was willing to say, hey, wait a minute, I feel lonely. That's a brave, in my opinion, that's a brave thing in this culture for a 34-year-old man to say very openly, like, I feel lonely. I feel like I've been lied to culturally about what's going to make me feel good because I don't feel good. I think that people really responded to that because we spend our time just trying not to say that.
And we're out of time, so I'll stop here, and I'm not going to ask you what you're doing next. But if it, thank you so much for doing this, Jason.
Thanks,
really,
man.
Thank
this
you.
Was a blast.
My guest is Jason Segel. He's starring as David Foster Wallace in the film The End of the Tour. The show is recorded and mixed by Kat Yoris, edited by Blake Veit, who's the associate producer. I have nothing left to say. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.